This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Number is 503-251-2344.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Jamie Partridge, your host for Labor Radio tonight. The talk you're about to hear is by Lucy Herschel on Marxism and the trade union struggle. It was given June 28th of this year at Socialism 2012 conference in Chicago, sponsored by Haymarket Books, the International Socialist Review, and the International Socialist Organization. The full talk is available at wearemany.org. Now, Lucy Herschel on Marxism and the trade union struggle.
I'd like to start off with a little story that I think really like shows the kind of infuriating schizophrenia of the trade union bureaucracy. And you know, this is actually a contract campaign manual that my union, SEIU, put out. They reprinted it sometime in the 2000s. And it's actually a very useful guide for how do you organize a shop floor campaign, how do you mobilize the membership, how do you use escalating tactics against the boss, up to and including strike action. And what's even more interesting is that and there's a nice little smiling Stern of the former president, Andy, smiling picture of the former president, Andy Stern, you know, right on the front. And, you know, what's even more interesting is that there's an introduction written to this manual that actually, you know, makes an explicit argument for mobilization of the membership against the boss versus the partnership model so dominant in the union movement today. And it says that over time, the cozy relationship between union and employers has become bureaucratic and, quote, at time fairly cozy, with unions stressing striking deals with management, and that this manual is supposed to harken back to a different time when workers had to mobilize on the shop floor to actually win and defend their gains against the bosses. Now, this might be kind of interesting that in the middle of the years 2000, SEIU is putting out a contract manual specifically arguing for mobilization against partnership, whereas in 2006, Andy Stern published a book. Andy Stern, the president of the International at the time, wrote a book that actually argues the exact opposite. And in his book in 2006, he actually argues that the rough and tumble class struggle world of the 1930s is sort of a thing of the past, and that unions and businesses should work in partnerships and alliances for a win-win situation. And this has certainly been SEIU's practice across the country, to the extreme that they were, you know, negotiating secret deals with nursing homes in California, where they were bargaining away members' rights before they even signed a union card. And this is not just SEIU. I mean, this is like across the labor movement, a dominant strategy of partnership, you know, with the boss, win-win. We in corporate America, you know, can work together to the benefit of everybody. And so, not surprisingly, this contract campaign manual was actually suppressed within SEIU, and like I had to go through back door channels to even get my hands on it. And so, when we did get our hands on it, we were like, look. This is what we've been talking about, you know what I mean? Like mobilizing the membership, putting pressure on the boss, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we were dismissed and told, well, you know, the manual's actually a little dated and, you know, those tactics don't apply anymore. But to this day, this is what me and some of my coworkers use to show our members to say, look, this is actually how, you know, it's supposed to be done, regardless of what you hear from the top. And I tell this story because I think it just helps to reveal how contradictory the nature of trade unions are. Despite the official partnership line, somewhere in the bureaucracy, there's clearly a recognition that you need some of those rough and tumble tactics, that or something, or at least some version of it, to do effective union organizing. And throughout unions today, you hear this constant kind of kvetching from the top about how do we mobilize the members, why aren't they more active? And yet, real rank and file activity, real militancy, actually scares the crap out of them. As we saw in the Madison occupation capital, the Madison Capitol occupation last year, union officials, managed to wind down and channel back into the more kind of predictable channels of electoral politics and everything else. And I think that this dual consciousness in the labor movement comes from the contradictory role that unions themselves play in capitalist society. On the one hand, unions are formed as the elemental way that working people band together to challenge their exploitation under capitalism. In that regard, their strength comes from the membership and the collective power. However, unions themselves are not revolutionary organizations set up to overthrow capitalism. Therefore, they develop bureaucracies and leaders whose role is to actually act as a mediator between workers and the bosses within the framework of capitalism. Throughout history, these bureaucracies have a tendency to become bureaucratic, conservative, and when push comes to shove, to actually contain workers' struggles within the framework of capitalist relations. Some of the points I want to make in this presentation are, first of all, that we have to understand unions as they are one and the same time. They are vehicles for class struggle, and they are also vehicles of class collaboration to maintain it within the capitalist framework. They are both the indispensable formation for workers as they begin to fight against capitalism, and they are the institutions that will hold struggle to try to maintain it within the capitalist framework. The second point is that this understanding is an incredibly important rudder to have when you're trying to deal with with trade union activism, because the betrayal of union leaders can just be totally paralyzing. You know what I mean? For especially my coworkers, they're like, how are we supposed to fight, you know what I mean, when our union won't even support us and they're pushing the same line as management? And I think it means that we have to have a two-pronged approach to work within unions, both seeking every opportunity to help form unions push them forward at the same time as understanding their limitations. We need a dynamic understanding of the relationship between the leadership and the rank and file of unions, and understand that union leaders are caught between capitalism and workers and can be pressured and shaped by our side in the struggles from below. And the final point I want to make is just that the dual nature of the union movement is one of the reasons why we need to be building an explicit socialist project that seeks to influence and lead within the union movement, but is independent of the trade union movement. Unions by nature are and design are not revolutionary bodies and will hold back struggle at key moments. We need an independent socialist project that can win working class people to go beyond the limits of trade unionism and to fight against the system of capitalism itself. So I just want to step back for a minute and talk about why basic trade union struggle is so inextricably linked with the struggle for socialism. And it's funny, my union actually put out this pamphlet called What is a Union? Which I think puts it really well, although unfortunately this pamphlet is no longer in circulation. And it just says that, what is a union? A union is an organization of everybody who works for the same employer using their collective strength to, one, prevent the boss from doing whatever he wants, and two, make demands of the boss to do whatever the workers want. And I think in a lot of ways that does encapsulate that, union organizing is basically about control. It's basically about who controls what happens at the work site. Is it going to be the boss or is it going to be the workers? And all you have to do is expand that beyond the walls of a particular workplace to say that about society. Who controls society? Is it going to be the small group of bosses at the top, or is it going to be the vast majority of workers from below? And I think, Karl Marx's collaborator, Friedrich Engels, put it this way about the centrality of union organizing back when he was talking about the early trade union movement in England. He said, what gives these unions and the strikes arising from them their real importance is this, that they are the first attempt of workers to abolish competition. They imply the recognition of the fact that the supremacy of the bourgeoisie, the supremacy of the bosses, is based wholly upon the competition of the workers among themselves. That is, upon their lack of cohesion. And precisely because unions direct themselves at the vital nerve of the present social order, however one-sidedly, in however a narrow way, they are dangerous to the social order. So just the very nature of workers trying to overcome competition and act collectively is a challenge to the entire capitalist system, which relies on the division and competition between workers. And you would think then, therefore, that all socialists would always support union struggles. And that's not the case. And going back to Marx and Engels, many of their contemporary socialists actually saw unions as, you know, too limited in scope, too narrowly focused on improving conditions within capitalism, and not focused on transcending capitalism itself. And many of these socialists also had very elitist positions towards union struggles and sought to sort of impose their socialist ideas on unions from the top down and demand that the unions, you know, obey the politics of their political parties first and foremost.
You're listening to Labor Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM.
You know, Marx and Engels, I think, were ahead of the curve in terms of their support for unions and basic union struggle because of their commitment, as laid out in the Communist Manifesto, that the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself. Marx was very insistent that socialism could not be engineered from above by any party or clique, no matter how well-intentioned, but had to be built from the ground up by ordinary working people taking control of their lives, taking control of their workplaces, as well as their schools and neighborhoods and everything else, and building a new society based on new institutions of working-class democratic rule. Marx and Engels saw unions as the most basic and elementary form of class organization in this struggle. Engels, writing about strikes, said, they are the military school of the working men in which they prepare themselves for the great struggle which cannot be avoided. Marx and Engels as emphasized how unions were, you know, union struggle was how workers learned to do all sorts of things, administrative tasks, you know, how do you organize a meeting, you know what I mean, like all things like that, and basically how to run their own affairs, which could then be, you know, carried over into a socialist society of people, workers actually organizing, running society as a whole. But most of all, Marx and Engels emphasized how union struggles collectivized people and created class consciousness. And it's how working class people become, what they talk about is going from a class in itself to a class for itself, meaning that working people have a recognition that we as a class have a common interest against a common enemy, and if we unite and have solidarity, we can win that struggle. And I think you can see throughout history that happening, you know, mass strikes, you know, in this country, from the general strike, you know, whether it's the general strike in Seattle in 1919 or the Madison Capitol occupation, just that sense of solidarity that can seemingly come out of nowhere in a world where we're so divided and we're so pitted against each other, that solidarity of like we're all on one side against a common enemy, and people coming together to organize mass food distribution and childcare and healthcare and all these kind of things, again, in a way that sort of points forward to a new society. At the same time, you know, when workers organize on a mass scale, they inevitably face repression from the state, which then calls into question, well, whose side is the state on? I thought we were in some sort of democracy where, you know, we were all on equal terms here, and it actually, you know, calls into question the whole nature of the society that we live in. So here's the question, though. If class struggle can lead working people through union organizing and through all sorts of class struggle, can lead working people to revolutionary conclusions, then why aren't unions revolutionary themselves? And I think the answer lies in the fact that for the most part, unions develop not at the height of struggle necessarily, but in non-revolutionary times, when the majority of working people have reformist consciousness at best. And by structure and design, unions are reformist institutions and not revolutionary ones. And Marx, you know, Marx was clear about the limitations of unions. He said, they ought not to forget that they are fighting the effects, but not the causes of those effects. They are retarding the downward movement, but not changing its direction. They are applying palliatives, but not curing the malady. And that was his, you know, diagnosis of unions. And I think the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky really hit it on the head of what this paradox is when he wrote, again, talking about the British labor movement. He wrote this. He wrote, "The trade union embraces the broad masses of workers at different levels. The broader the masses, the closer the trade union is to accomplishing its task. But what the organization gains in breadth, it inevitably loses in depth. Opportunistic, nationalistic, religious tendencies in the trade unions and their leadership express the fact that the unions embrace not only the vanguard, not only, you know, the most advanced conscious workers, but also the heavy reserves." And this is the important sentence, I think he says. "The weak side of unions, therefore, comes from its strong side." So you can't undo that. You know what I mean? Like they're actually connected. The strength, the breadth and strength of unions, it leads to also the weakness, which is that they're not going to be revolutionary organizations. And this goes back to what Karl Marx said about the dominant ideas in any society or the ideas of the ruling class. You know, for this reason, the Russian revolutionary Lenin also argues that if you limit your political work to trade unionism, that actually means he calls it the ideological enslavement of workers to the bourgeoisie, meaning that you're not actually challenging the very ruling ideas of capitalism and everything else because of the nature of the struggle. And what are the bourgeois ideas of society? They're the ideas that actually maintain capitalism, and you know they are things like racism, sexism, and other biases that divide the working class and pit us all against each other rather than uniting to fight the people at the top. But bourgeois ideology is also the basic idea that capitalism is the natural way to organize things, that the best we can do is reform it. It can also mean accepting the assumption that workers have to compete with each other, you know, and that we have to take sacrifices so that the business can compete, you know what I mean, and make a profit and everything else. And that's exactly the line that, you know, that bosses and labor leaders, too, in the auto industry in particular, have united around to convince auto workers that they have to take concessions in order to, so that the business can compete and make a profit and continue to operate. And for anyone who hasn't read it, I really have all these books here. Really recommend Greg Shotwell's book, Auto Workers Under the Gun, which is all about how that logic of giving into the capitalist logic of competition just leads down, you know, a terrible road in terms of, you know, union strength and defending our interests. So Okay, so sort of established that, you know, consciousness, because of the breadth of unions, they're not gonna be revolutionary, they're gonna have all sorts of ideas, et cetera. But, you know, Marxism also holds that workers, because working people have a material interest in overthrowing capitalism, they can also be drawn to revolution, through struggle, they are drawn to revolutionary conclusions in large numbers. And that has happened through history. However, there's something different about the union bureaucracy. The union bureaucracy actually doesn't have a material interest in overthrowing capitalism. The union bureaucracy exists within capitalism and is actually, you know, built up as a way to negotiate between the workers and the bosses. You know, in periods of heightened struggle, you know, the structure and leadership of unions has historically been a barrier to the advancing of struggles and have sought to redirect class anger into more manageable channels. There's very clear material differences between, like, labor, you know, your average labor leader and your average rank and file worker. First of all, is just pay. You know what I mean? There was a very embarrassing thing that came out during the Occupy Wall Street stuff about labor's 1% and like how there's a huge percentage of labor leaders who would actually technically fit within the category of the 1% given, you know, making like $350,000 a year or something like that. So there's, you know, their pay and their whole, you know, worldview is shaped by that. But there's also the fact that, you know, all labor staff is removed from the shop floor. They're not actually the ones dealing with the boss on a day-to-day basis. So every struggle in the workplace to, you know, improve our working conditions actually just creates more work for the staff and everybody else, you know what I mean, who are working with us. And that's just a material difference that people have to recognize. And I think there's a whole worldview that sort of evolves out of, you know, this whole contradiction. And, you know, Farrell Dobbs put it really well, I think. He was an American socialist and union militant, talking about, you know, labor bureaucrats. And I'm just going to quote him for a second. And sort of their view of, and this doesn't apply to all labor bureaucrats, but this is like, but it applies to more than we would like. Labor bureaucrats don't look upon the labor movement as a fighting instrument dedicated solely to the workers' interests. They tend rather to view trade unions as a base upon which to build personal careers as labor statesmen. And he really likes that term, labor statesman. He uses it a lot. Such ambitions can cause them to seek collaborative relations with the ruling class. Toward that end, bureaucrats argue that employers, being providers of jobs, employers being providers of jobs, labor and capital have common interests. They contend that exploiters of labor must make fair profits, so if they are to pay fair wages. Workers are told that they must be have a responsible attitude so as to make the bosses feel that unions are a necessary part of the business. On every count, the ruling class is given a big edge over the union rank and file. And this is Farrell Dobbs writing, you know, 80 years ago or something like that, and I think applies 100% to, you know, Andy Stern and his whole win-win, you know, sort of way of looking at things, as well as, you know, what I described with the UAW and the you know, we need to partnership and allow the boss to make a profit and help the boss in order to go forward. And then, you know, just to say, you know, also unions just tend to, they also develop these huge bureaucracies. You know, the United States labor movement has one of the biggest paid staff, like, in the world. A lot of unions have started to maintain themselves as administrators of big healthcare funds and pension funds and all these kind of things. And then that apparatus becomes the important thing to protect, not the particular wage of the worker on the shop floor. And, you know, in addition to that, you know, any kind of labor militancy, like strikes or things like that, actually endangers that bureaucracy, because you could have court fines, you know what I mean? You could have injunctions, leaders could be put in jail, the government could intervene and take over your union. And so, you know, maintaining that union structure becomes more important than, you know, what are the needs of the workers and what are the workers willing to risk in order to fight for a better wage? And I think because of all this, the leadership finds itself in a bind, for at the same time that their whole existence is based on the stated goal of protecting and improving working conditions for members, and, you know, at the same time that's their stated goal, they actually have a fear of the rough and tumble class war, and are much more comfortable with the kind of negotiations and everything else. And then that means that the militants within the union, the people who are arguing for a more militant strategy, for a more aggressive strategy, they become the problem. You know what I mean? They become the people that, you know, need to be put down and controlled. And it can create a quite antagonistic relationship within the union between kind of the militants from below and some of the more, especially the more, you know, entrenched top-down leaders. So, you know, where does all this leave us if we have this analysis of trade unions as being both vehicles of class struggle, but also class collaboration? And for the experience of people on the shop floor, it can be quite paralyzing. You know what I mean? Because it's like, it's hard enough to organize your coworkers. I think I said this before. It's hard enough to organize your coworkers against the boss. If you have to also fight your union, it just feels like, what are you supposed to do? And so very often people get very focused on, like, well, we just have to get rid of this union leader and bring in a new union leader, and looking for those kind of shortcuts. And undoubtedly, like, who the union leadership is actually very important. And I think we can see that in Chicago right now, where you have a militant union leadership that's come up through the ranks, that's proved itself in struggle, and it's actually made a world of difference in terms of, you know, actually putting a real fight against the attacks on teachers forward and just completely change, you know, is posing the potential for a breakthrough in union organizing that we haven't, and struggle that we haven't seen in a long time. But the question is sort of like, how did they get there? You know what I mean? And they didn't get there just by constantly criticizing the union bureaucracy. They got there through organizing from below in a way that can actually push things forward.
That's all the time we have for this evening. You are listening to Labor Radio on KBOO. That was Lucy Herschel on Marxism and the Trade Union Struggle. The full talk is available at wearemany.org. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline and tune in again on next Monday evening and every Monday evening for Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class, the only show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
You've been listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is 6:29. That was Labor Radio. Up next, we have Prison Pipeline. Labor Radio has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and elevate the moral and social conditions of its members. Information at ubc156.org. Keep it tuned here for Prison Pipeline, coming up next at KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater presents a monthly film series on the second Thursday of each month. January 10th at 7 p.m., we present the 1988 film Talk Radio, in which a rude, contemptuous talk show host becomes overwhelmed by the hatred that surrounds his program just before it goes national.
Can you your mouth and tell me what we're going to do about the mess this country's in. Talk radio. It's the last neighborhood in town. People just don't talk to each other anymore. Let's go to the first caller. Night Talk.
Before the film, we'll hear Carl Wilson, who will talk about his experience as a talk show host in Portland. And the film will be introduced by a KBOO board member and Wednesday morning talk show host, Lisa Loving. That's January 10th at the Clinton Street Theater at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboofilms.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Oliver is 6'2" and looks lean for his 210 pounds. He has short hair, and when you look into his piercing blue eyes, you can tell he has a history to tell. Sam has written a memoir titled 27 Seasons that details the years of physical, sexual, and psychological abuse he has faced in his youth at the hands of multiple abusers. You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, and Hood River at 90.9 FM. I'm your host, Peter Pincel, and tonight we're speaking with Sam Oliver about his life, the cycle of child abuse that affects our society and those in our justice system, and how he broke free of it.